Hello, everybody, and welcome back again to the Gaming News Canada show. As always, I'm your host, Steve McAllister. To quote Charles Dickens, these are crazy times for the betting industry. And as Charles Dickens said in Tale of Two Cities, these are the best of times. These are the worst of times. So much going on. And so really wanted to get three journalists to cover this industry to kind of bring their balanced, measured perspectives on all of the stories that are happening in the sports betting industry particularly. So we do want to welcome to the show the editor-in-chief of SBC Americas and the co-host of the iGaming Daily podcast, Jessica Wellman. Jess, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Although, to quote Dickens, like, bah humbug at all of this terrible news we're going to have to discuss.
Yes, that too. This may end up being a Dickens podcast instead of a gambling podcast. Want to welcome back to the show as well, the sports betting gambling industry beat writer for covers.com, Jeff Ciccone. Jeff, thanks for joining us on this Easter Monday.
Thanks for having me back on.
And making his maiden appearance on the Gaming News Canada show, and I can't believe I'm saying that, is the managing editor of Play Canada, Play Michigan, Play Pennsylvania, and also, maybe most importantly, the host of the Fresh Waves podcast, Dave Briggs. Dave, thanks so much, and this is long overdue.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's a privilege to be here.
Hey, just going back to the Dickens line for a second, and just, you know, looking at all the storylines that are out there in the industry right now and in the U.S., where, you know, we've read a lot on the weekend of the launch of the North Carolina legal sports betting market and how it's taken off with a bang. And also, as we record this podcast on Easter Monday, news this morning from the New York Gaming Commission that the online sports betting handle for the second last week of March was $539.6 million. And that's the second highest weekly amount wagered since the state legalized mobile sports betting back in, I think, start of 2022. This week, and we'll get into this a little bit later, the Ontario regulated sports betting iGaming industry is going to recognize its second anniversary. And we look at a market today with 47 licensed operators, I think somewhere around 75 gambling websites in the province, and not including the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation. And then when you look at the not so good side, obviously the Shohei Ohtani, the $4.5 million in gambling debts that appears to involve his interpreter, Ipe Mizuhara, also involving an alleged California bookmaker in a state where there isn't legal sports betting, which is one of the big stories in pro sports. Closer to home, Jaden Porter of the Toronto Raptors would be being investigated around what seems to be suspicious prop bets. And then we see in the U.S., which Jess, Dave, and Jeff cover right now, the banning of prop bets in various jurisdictions around U.S. college sports and kind of the spit storm that's created. And then just the ongoing debate around sports betting advertising and problem gambling, and also getting a bit of seems to be a bit more buzz lately around the limiting of bettors by regulated operators. Jess, maybe I'll just start with you and we'll throw it out, get this roundtable going. Like, what stories really stick out to you right now? And again, I was enjoying your tweets over the last week about what's going on in Georgia. And does it feel like your head's swimming and maybe the Easter weekend was a good time to try to clear that head?
You know, Georgia, it was to use a really depressing metaphor, it was like watching someone being taken off life support. Are they technically still alive? Sure. Am I in the room to be polite? Yes. Do I know what the end result is going to be? Also, yes. So that one, it was more just time consuming than anything else. And I think, to me, the more interesting stuff that was happening, I think Reese Davis, his comment on ESPN, to use the phrase risk-free in particular off the cuff the way he did, making what he claimed was a joke, but really, to me, just as someone who has had to fill dead air, just feels like you're kind of filling the air and trying to come up with an outro and you said something dumb. Seeing that, and then I think it's not the most interesting story, but I think the timing of it is very funny to me. This Responsible Online Gambling Association announcing last week that it was formed. It felt like simultaneously good and bad timing. There was a voice in my head that's like, oh, don't worry, everybody. We formed a coalition. we've got it under control. Then it was just like after the whole SNL thing of basically being spoofed for being insincere about this stuff, it landed with a tone of insincerity to me that I think didn't really help the cause for the industry.
Hey, Jeff, which one of the stories I mentioned and maybe the ones that Jeff mentioned are the ones that kind of keep you awake at night, or you just can't get them out of your mind?
Well, Georgia literally kept me awake at night because they did not adjourn until like 1 a.m. So I was not able to get to sleep at a reasonable hour. But it was kind of funny there as well, because the holdup was kind of divorced from all the doom and gloom going on in the sports betting world. There was no debate about whether or not it was ethical or moral to legalize sports betting. It was more about how should we spend the proceeds of sports betting. And that seemed to be where they got bogged down and where it fell apart. And even though you might have had no chance to begin with, that was kind of the public discourse going on there. So it was kind of funny in that way. But I mean, for me, the Jonte Porter stuff really jumped off the page to me, because that was kind of like a nightmare scenario for the league. When you look at the Ohtani thing, it's happening in a state where there is no legal sports betting, and it's happening, you know, allegedly in some very unregulated ways. And so that's not really like a byproduct, you could say, of the legalization of sports betting, because it is not involving that at all. Again, allegedly, we'll see where everything's going there. But the Porter stuff was more what, you know, the NBA has been probably the most vocal in support of sports betting. You had Adam Silver kind of go out on a limb before his fellow commissioners did the same to push for it. And then you had this issue crop up. And I think that to me is just like, it's one of those situations where, you know, when you envision bad stuff happening through the legalization of sports betting, like, that is kind of one of the nightmare scenarios that you get, I think.
Hey, just on the Porter situation, and you know, Declan Hill, who's covered, written about match fixing for years, and now is at the University of New Haven. He's talked to a couple of journalists last week and mentioned that this is the end. The honeymoon's coming to the end with legalized sports betting, and it's beginning of the end. Maybe I'll start, Dave, with you on that. Is just how much validity is there to that? Do you think that the honeymoon has come to an end with professional sports, and that there is kind of a day of reckoning right now?
Yeah, I think we're in the early stages of that, but I can see that that's beginning to happen. It's just so prevalent across North America now, and it's ingrained in everybody's consciousness that, you know, it's inevitable a certain small percentage are going to run afoul of the rules and cause problems. And, you know, what struck me about the Porter situation was, you know, we've basically been told by the match fixing folks, the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sport, all those people, that it's not likely to happen at the professional level on any very serious level. It's probably going to be amateur athletes or, you know, barely professional athletes struggling to make a living that are inclined to take some kind of payment to survive. Yeah, he's not a star in the NBA for sure, but making a professional salary, and this happens. So that opened my eyes, and I thought, it's reached that. Not, you know, I'm not naive. It's possible to reach anybody if it's the right amount and the right people and the right pressure. So I think all those things happening at once are scary for the industry, but were slightly inevitable. It's so prevalent now. It's such a daily thing. People are holding it in their hands. So we're going to see a certain percentage of bad action from people who are going to cause harm to the industry and the sport.
Hey, Jess, it's been 6 years now since PASPA was overturned. Like, why do we have this spit storm now with all this stuff going on? Do you think it's just a coincidence, or do you think it's the fact that we've added more regulated sports betting markets to the U.S. and we have regulated gaming in Ontario now? But it does seem a bit odd that it's taken us 6 years to get here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a couple of things that I think have raised eyebrows, certainly what happened in Iowa last year with all of those athletes, although that seemed to largely be that they were wagering on themselves, to be fair. And then the NBA or the NFL, you know, Calvin Ridley, you had that. We've had small ones, and this, I think, is the one that it seems to be the most obvious instance of, you know, really fundamentally undermining the betting integrity of everything versus maybe breaking league rules or just betting on yourself versus, you know, failing on purpose, arguably. I think some of this, though, is that the people at US Integrity and these other agencies are doing a very good job of noticing these things. I know that is the rose-colored glasses we put on this, but it's really a fair thing to say that we wouldn't even have known this was going on necessarily if this industry didn't exist. That I'm not surprised that we have these hiccups. And, you know, the whole Ohtani thing, I have read very little about it, to be honest, because I feel like it's so far removed from what we do. You know, like, it's not like, oh, well, if California had legal sports betting, this guy would be waltzing into Harrah's Rincon making these bets for him for millions of dollars. You know, like, this situation only exists in a legal way that it's hard to even kind of group it with the rest of these. That, to me, it doesn't feel as much of a storm of a bunch of things as we've got this. We've got kind of a questionable situation going on in Temple that hasn't reached a resolution, but you know, that the biggest one is just so far removed from what we're doing that it's, I think, can maybe impacting how people are viewing this in a way that it shouldn't.
Yeah. Hey Jeff, the one thing that surprised me is I did a sports podcast last week, and we were talking about the Ohtani situation and Porter. And I guess the one thing that continues to surprise me is that athletes actually think it's okay to gamble, or that there seems to be an ignorance around athletes about the rules around betting. And one of the hosts in the podcast, he and I first met when I was covering the Toronto Blue Jays back in the early 90s. And he was a producer with the All Sports radio station in Toronto. And back then, when you walked in the Blue Jays clubhouse, the first thing you saw was a sign in the door for Major League Baseball saying you can't bet on baseball. And there does seem to be, you would think the common sense would dictate that, yeah, it's probably not a good idea for me to bet on a sport that I'm playing in or coaching in or officiating in. And yet here we are. And you know, I don't know if there's a, I find it hard to accept the fact that there's a lack of education for these guys about what you can and can't do.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's probably a good juncture here to say we don't really know what's gone on with Jonte Porter himself here. You know, there's stuff that's been put out there. We don't know if there are any formal allegations against him. That's their investigation being launched into the activity that's surrounding his prop betting markets. And so, you know, we don't have a firm grasp really on the facts on what's being, if he's even the one that's being looked at, or if it's just an association with him. So it's all very alleged and reported and suspected up to this point. But, to what you were just saying there, the NBA is kind of interesting because, you know, you mentioned MLB where they have that hard, fast rule tacked up when you walk in the clubhouse. They have a history of some very eye-opening scandals, right? Going back to the Black Sox scandal, to Pete Rose, where it really scarred the sport to the point that, you know, they want to be very clear about what is and what isn't permitted, because they just are still dealing with the fallout from that, you know, decades after the fact. And so the NBA is kind of curious because you, as an NBA player, are allowed to wager on other sports. So that kind of clouds the picture a little bit for what is and what isn't permitted. And, you know, you have also a bit of a historical culture of gambling, you know, not on sports, but in the NBA in general, where you have the famous stories of Michael Jordan, you know, spending time in casinos and, you know, being a real, you know, the big shot kind of stories about playing at the tables, you know, late into the hours in Atlantic City, that kind of thing. So it's funny when you look at all the different rules of the sports, they kind of reflect the history of gambling and their interactions with gambling. And so that kind of shines through, I think, a bit here. And it also might be contributing to perhaps some of the confusion on the behalf of players, because, you know, Jonte Porter in this instance, he's someone who he's not a huge star. He hasn't been in the league for decades or years. You know, he's someone who just kind of caught on this year and is, you know, played his way to a bit more of a rotational role for the Raptors, but, you know, he's not a mainstay in the NBA by any means. And so it's kind of, it's just, it's sort of funny from that perspective.
To chime in really quickly too, the MLB is one of the only leagues that explicitly has a rule that you can't bet on any kind of baseball. You can't bet on college baseball. You can't bet on baseball in Japan. You can't bet on baseball, you know, on the moon. The NFL, you can bet on college football, which, just a reminder, these people are fresh out of and still have ties to, and it's really murky. So I there's still a lot of work to do on the league's parts. You know, the MLB kind of has a formal policy about this, but I don't believe the NBA does either, of just like, if it's your sport, you can't touch this. And so that seems like a pretty easy fix.
Hey, Jess, I want to stick with you just on the whole. I mentioned the what's going on with prop bets in U.S. college sports, and there seems to be two trains of thought there. One is that if regulated operators get rid of prop bets, all you do is push people towards illegal sports books to make those bets. And the other side is that, yeah, I mean, college sports, young athletes, you should be limiting the kinds of bets that can be placed on those kids. What are you hearing from people across the industry on the prop bet issue?
I have a lot of people who very violently disagree with me, which is not surprising given that it's me. But for me, I have always thought that college props are just gross. It just looks gross. It feels wrong. And it seems like a very easy PR layup to just say, we're not going to do this. Some of these guys are not even 18. They're just barely 18. When you look at a Division I basketball program, like, sure, there are the people, the UKs and the Kansases and the UConns of the world, but there's also, you know, Eastern Kentucky University, and, you know, offering props on somebody on the Eastern Kentucky University basketball team is just asking for trouble. That's always been my take on it. And the pushback I've gotten is that this is just lip service getting rid of this, that it's just, you know, doing something for the PR of it all. And I have to say, like, well, isn't that better than doing nothing? I mean, we took a collective victory lap as an industry because we decided to ban risk-free and get out of thesaurus and come up with different ways of saying the same exact thing, and acted like that accomplished something. At least this feels like a little more proactive than that. What I do hear, and I don't know if you guys agree with this one, it seems far-fetched to me, is like, well, if you give the NCAA this, they're going to come for all of college betting. And I'm like, I don't really see that happening. As a living in a state where we don't have a single professional sports team, I just don't envision that being something that has weight and is popular. You know, the NCAA will go to their conferences in these schools and hear about the money they're getting from data deals and things like that. And I don't think that they would push for this, but I could be overly optimistic about it.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, any thoughts on that, given your ties to Pennsylvania and Michigan?
Yeah, I'm right in the middle of this, because Michigan's a wide open college prop betting state. They're one of the few. They told us last week they're going to, the Michigan Gaming Control Board said they were going to take a look at this. I don't know what that means. That probably means we have to acknowledge the NCAA has put pressure on us. You know, I'm a little bit in your first camp, Steve. I do think it's popular enough that it's going to push some people to unregulated markets, and those bets will still exist. And whatever, you know, bad result for the college athlete, which is terrible and unfortunate, and they should never be harassed, nor should anyone, it's still going to continue, because people are going to have money on prop bets somewhere. So I don't know how you don't eliminate it. You're just having a PR exercise to say, we don't allow it here. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, go do it somewhere illegally if you want to do it. I don't think that's any better. I don't think it's solving the problem. Obviously education has to play a major part here, as well, but yeah, so I'm stuck. It's a tough one. Perhaps limiting what you can bet on in terms of props might help a little bit, but I, again, it's a little bit more like lip service to it.
Hey, Jeff, any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I have a few, and I'm kind of stuck in that tug of war that Dave mentioned, because I can see it from a few different angles. One angle I see is that Ohio actually laid out a pretty interesting case for the banning of college player props in the letter that the executive director of the Casino Control Commission wrote in response to the NCAA's request. And he pointed out, Matthew Schuler, the director, that only, I think, 1.35% of all bets that were placed in Ohio in the first year of legal sports betting were those kind of college player prop bets that the NCAA wanted to see banned. And so that's a very small portion of the overall market. At the same time, if you look at, you know, who are the biggest players in U.S. sports betting right now, it's DraftKings and it's FanDuel, and they have that fantasy history and, you know, that real familiarity with statistical player stats and people, their interest in that. And so there's a real, you could have a situation where, you know, the overall handle of these bets is fairly small, but you're getting a lot of tickets because you have a lot of, you know, former fantasy players that are interested in player props through their history with fantasy sports. So there could still be a demand, but it's just not the overall wagering that's happening on it isn't huge. So I can, you know, I see what Ohio did, and Ohio also has been a very influential regulator of sports betting, including going back to the language piece that was mentioned earlier by Jessica about, you know, when they were getting ready to launch, saying, here's what you can and can't say, and taking a very active role in disciplining operators leading up to and after the launch about their promotional efforts. So it could be that other states just sort of crib from the playbook that they laid out there.
Hey, Jess, we're going to lose you early. So I want to ask you two questions before we let you go. And I'll follow up with Jeff and Dave on these two issues later. And one quickly is to go back to the Responsible Gaming Coalition announcement from last week. And again, responsible gambling seems to be such a problem. Gambling is such a hot button topic. Is there a simple solution, Jess, that you see, or is there something that is there too much right now just talking the talk and there needs to be more walking the walk? Like where does the industry go with RG? Because I think it's become a real controversial issue for the industry.
You know, Jeff was on Georgia duty. I think the most interesting thing that happened in Georgia was that they managed to get an amendment in there that 15%, I think it was, up to 150 million of revenues coming, tax revenues coming off of sports betting was going to be earmarked for responsible gambling. You're not going to get anywhere near 150 million. You would have had to do like 4 billion in revenue to get anywhere near this number. The percentage, though, is massive. The idea that someone would even give 20 million, 15 million to this effort when states are earmarking $750,000. Or, you know, I think it was Massachusetts had kind of an expose of like, we have all these funds and you're not even spending them. Like, what are you? Nobody, you need to take money and you need to spend it on treatment and awareness and the things to actually deal with the issue. We're at, you know, three coalitions now. We got the one with the broadcasters and the leagues. We got the affiliate one. We got the operator one. Until I see these people lobbying in Georgia and places for amendments like this, it just feels kind of stupid, I'll be honest. Like, I'm not going to make any friends on this, but like, you know, I, short of naming directors, I've not heard any release from any of these people beyond announcing that they exist. So unless you're going to go lobby and do these sorts of things, you know, it certainly doesn't help that these groups are in opposition of the GRIT Act, which is earmarking that federal excise tax money for responsible gambling, which I fully get. You don't want the tax to exist. It makes sense to oppose it. Optically, it's not the best situation to claim that you care about this, and then the one federal bill to address it, you oppose.
And last question, Jess, and that's on the two-year anniversary of Ontario. And again, Ontario falls into your roles and responsibilities at SPC Americas.
Just and Canadian gaming business.
Yeah, is that too? Just some general thoughts on 2 years of what you've seen in Ontario with this highly competitive market. And obviously, it's anytime you us Canadians go to a gambling conference south of the border, we get asked about Ontario and what provinces are going to come next.
You know, it's interesting. I very distinctly remember that first revenue report coming out of Ontario and thinking, oh, this is bad. And I will stand fully corrected. It was the most interesting thing to me about Ontario is the way that its growth has taken a much different trajectory than we've seen in the United States. And it's so robust with so many operators. And we've seen a few leave, but the fact there's room for so many people in this province is really interesting too. The advertising thing, it's kind of the same debate we have here. I know you guys are probably going to talk about this. Is it Mura? I think it is. Maru is the poll. To just quickly weigh in on that one, I always go back to the methodology of these things and looking into it. This is a poll of people who sign up to answer polls for money, which, like, ask yourself what kind of people those are. And then two, looking at the results, I'm not particularly surprised that older people with more disposable income who have no interest in sports betting are generally the people who think there are too much sports betting ads on television. Like, I think that's another, you know, you guys have the same problem that we have in the United States. They put out these polls, people pull these incredibly alarming numbers and statistics, and they don't really go in and look and be like, oh, wow, people over the age of 55 think there are too many ads on television.
Yeah, it reminds me of the of my newspaper days when we used to do surveys in the newspaper, and you knew the only people filling out the surveys were 60-year-olds, 60-year-old plus, to get the chance to win $25 the groceries or whatever, or the, you know, the 28-inch TV to put in your kitchen. Jessica Wellman is the editor-in-chief of SBC Americas. Jess, always great to have you on the show. You can find Jess too at Jess Wellman on the social media platform formerly known as Twitter. Jess, we'll get you back on again soon when you stay longer, but we do appreciate you hopping on and joining us for at least part of the podcast today.
Yeah, appreciate the invite, and sorry to cut things short, but such is the life. Jeff predicted a quiet week. Mine has not been so far, but we'll see if it quiets down. So best of luck, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks, Jess. Hey, Dave, let's continue with Ontario, because Jess's comment at the top about kind of, you know, raising her a Spocky eyebrow when iGaming Ontario put out their first quarter results 2 years ago. I think you were part of that group too. I mean, I think you were fairly critical in Play Canada about those numbers and kind of question the marketplace. And obviously we're in a much different position as we sit here and talk today.
Yeah, we certainly were a little bit skeptical about the numbers. And one of the things that we did, of course, was convert that money to US dollars and then compare it to comparable jurisdictions. And when you did that, it was really shocking how low Ontario was to start out. Now, it's improved significantly, Steve. And one of the other things we did, once we got the OLG numbers, we thought it's only fair to put the OLG numbers in with the IGO numbers. Add it all together, convert it to American dollars, compare, and then compare to the first year of comparable jurisdictions like Michigan and Pennsylvania, the two most obvious ones, New Jersey as well, of course, because they all have online casinos as well. And, you know, Ontario's still a little bit below Pennsylvania and Michigan, sort of third, fourth on that list for the first year of operation, but it came out a lot better when you looked at it under those terms. And again, like I mentioned, one of the problems we have here is the OLG numbers aren't included in the IGO numbers. So you have to wait till they put out their annual report and kind of figure it out. And also, IGO doesn't really give you that much information to begin with. I mean, it's a real struggle. Quarterly is not really acceptable by the terms of the rest of North America. Everybody else is monthly pretty much. And many places give you operator data that you can really get a better picture. So I'm hoping when we get to the start from year one to year two, they started in year two, the beginning of year two, giving us what online casino percentage was and handle and revenue versus poker versus sports betting. I'm hoping the beginning of year three, we're going to get operator breakdowns, but that's probably too much to wish for. But certainly the numbers are better. I was looking at the numbers as it's grown and trying to get a guess of what it would be when the full year is complete, when they send those numbers out. And it's you know, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% growth year over year. If it just stays stagnant in quarter four, if those numbers are about what quarter three were, you know, that's huge. That's pretty big numbers in just the second year of this.
Now, I do want to get into the IGO and AGCO with you guys a bit more in a few minutes. But Jeff, just I do want to get kind of your high level thoughts on the Ontario market with the 2 year anniversary happening on Thursday, April 4th.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Dave said there. The separation of IGO's handle and that of OLG is something that, if you're not familiar with how gambling works in Ontario, it can be confusing, right? You don't understand perhaps that there is such a large incumbent that was already there that had a very large loyal base of users that was gambling online and placing bets on sports and slots and all sorts of things before this competitive market even launched. So it was more of like an addition just to what was, you know, I don't think we ever got OLG reporting monthly handle figures for sports betting before the launch of this competitive market. We still don't have it now, but it was probably a decent chunk of action that was happening every month that we just couldn't wrap our arms around and then could not factor it into the overall picture of the market when IGO started releasing figures. And so I think the disclosure is getting better and the disclosures are helping inform the fact that we're seeing that this is a very sizable and significant market. If you look at, you know, the most recent figures, you look at overall wagering for like technically Ontario's third quarter, but it's the fourth quarter of 2023, where you saw, you know, $3 billion that was wagered just on sports over those 3 months. So $1 billion a month, say, that puts Ontario up just on sports betting terms of handle, you know, with like the Illinois and the New Jerseys of the world, which is, you know, they're significant markets for operators. So that's one thing. And I also think too that if you look at what's been going on, in the world of legalized sports betting, it's really been the U.S. that's been kind of like the driving force of understanding sports betting, including in Canada, where you have people looking at Ontario through the prism of that U.S. legalization, and people not quite comprehending. Just it's a bit of a different beast. And also, too, you know, you have only a handful of states that have legal online casino. That is a huge part in Ontario. And it's a huge reason why I think you've seen so many of these perhaps smaller operators hang on and keep the market numbers pretty big from an operator perspective, just because people can come in and, you know, sports betting is a bit more of an intensive business for, you know, you have to set lines, you have to watch out, you know, you have to watch the news on Sunday, you have to see who's being ruled in and out of games on the NFL on Sundays, because that could swing a line. You know, if a quarterback's out, that's huge. So you have to have people that are sort of minding the shop there. Whereas with online casino, the games are the games and you put them up, and the slot machines don't require a whole lot of attention. So it's a bit of a lower overhead thing. So that has helped, I think, keep the population of operators up too.
You know, Dave, it's interesting. I think almost since the market opened, there's been a lot of talk about consolidation and the market being too crowded, and when is there going to be a mass exodus? And yet here we sit on April 1st, and this is an April Fool's joke, but Unibet withdrew from the market last week, but had given notice several months ago that it was leaving Ontario and North America altogether. And we've had a couple of other operators leave since the market opened in April 2022. But nothing so far as we record this podcast on Monday. No, we don't see any other operators departing. We have Chris Sabin and Phil Gray and Amanda Brewer on the podcast frequently. And the chatter they're getting is that there still are operators who want to come and set up shop in Ontario. Has that surprised you, Dave, that we haven't seen the market shrink a little bit more than it has?
No, only because of what Jeff just said, which is online casinos are the key, and the margins are entirely different than sports betting. And so I think there's a lot of operators who are quite happy if they can get 1%, less than 1% of an online casino market, because it's lower overhead, et cetera, all those things that Jeff mentioned. So that's the key that's kept a lot of them in the game. And even the sports betting operators, most of them will tell you that's what they're trying to do, is funnel people over to online casino. So that's I think where the difference is. If we didn't have online casino, I think we would have lost a lot of operators by now, just due to competitive nature of it, that, you know, less than 1% stake of a sports betting only market is really tough business. You're losing a lot of money there. So it doesn't make sense to continue on, but you might be able, I don't know the exact figures, but you might be able to eke out decent, maybe not a profit, but decent money operating a smaller online casino just because it costs you less to do it.
Yeah. And we had Justin Park, the founder and CEO of Betty, on the podcast, the last episode. And I think ecstatic would be the word to describe Justin's reaction to launching in Ontario as its first regulated marketplace. And he's really bullish on being here in Ontario. And obviously, like, it feels like every other operator in Ontario, they're also watching what's happening in Alberta and BC and Quebec, and hoping that they can take the business they're running in Ontario and expand it into those other Canadian provinces at some point.
A word from our sponsor.
Hey there, sports fans. Are you looking for fresh and fun takes on the hottest topics in Canadian sports? Well, we've got just what you need. Introducing Homestand Sports Today, your go-to daily sports newsletter, bringing you the Canadian angle on the hottest NHL, NBA, footy stories, and more right to your inbox. But wait, there's more. Homestand Sports isn't just another text-heavy newsletter. Every story has its own video featuring our talented hosts like me, Albert Vartanian, giving you a newsletter experience like never before. And did I mention it's a free subscription? Subscribe now at homestand.ca.
Now back to the show.
Jeff, I want to talk to you just about, the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario put in effect the new advertising standards for operators at the end of February. And, it's been pretty quiet, which doesn't surprise me for a couple of reasons. One, I think, Jeff, we might have talked about this the last time you were on the podcast. We knew that this market was maturing and that there would be a leveling off of advertising and marketing spend at some point. So I don't think we should be too surprised that there hasn't been a lot of noise since those new standards went into effect.
Yeah, it's funny. We were actually talking about this morning on our editorial meeting, and somebody said that they were just seeing a ton of Connor McDavid over the weekend with all of talking responsible gambling. So it might be now, people are going to get beaten over the head with RG messaging, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? It could be a good reinforcement of some of the stuff out there. But yeah, I know it's it'll be curious to see where we go here, because there was, first of all, there was a purpose to the explosion, quote unquote explosion of advertising, because there are, I'm sure if you talk to people in the business, they'll point to the fact that a lot of advertising is still all the traditional stuff. It's just probably more the advertising goes on around sporting events is more related to sports betting now. But the overall advertising load you're seeing, if you sat down and watched a channel from sunup to sundown, would be the same kind of mix. But anyways, the purpose of that advertising was to alert people to the presence of these new licensed and regulated and legit operators, and to give those newer entrants who did not have a presence in the gray market in Ontario before then to, give them a chance to compete for business and to introduce themselves to Ontarians and let them know that they were there. So it did serve a purpose. It also, served their purposes. They were trying to acquire customers, of course, so that accounted for some of it. And now that we're at this point where, you can't use athletes and certain celebrities for certain purposes when it comes to advertising iGaming, I'm curious to see if we see a shift toward the quality of product, if people are going to compete more on what they're actually offering on the gaming side. Because if you go to a lot of different online sports books and casinos in Ontario, you're probably going to see very similar offerings from a lot of places, and not a ton of differentiator on the product side. And so I think now, companies, not only are they going to have to offer you a fair shake on odds and things like that, but I'm curious to see if we start seeing new products kind of pop up and attract people that way. And so it's overall been a pretty a long, strange trip, I guess you could say. I'm kind of reminded of Canada's experience in legalizing recreational cannabis, where in Ontario, you know, it was very restrictive on how they were allowed to advertise it. And, you know, to the point where you would walk by a cannabis store and you're like, you know, what's going on there? There's like a bouncer out front, you know, they're checking IDs. And like, they couldn't even like really say that, like, you know, we have weed in here. They didn't want to put too much out there. And you contrast that with the experience with sports betting, where it was just so explosive, like in people's faces. So it's been interesting. And I just, you know, I'm curious to see if operators kind of innovate on their advertising plans and also too on the product side.
Yeah, I want to get in that in a sec, Jeff, but I do want to ask both you and Dave, and Jess mentioned the Maru public opinion survey that was released last week. And just, you know, at the highest level, the survey found that 7 in 10 Canadians want team players and celebrities banned from sports betting ads. And a majority of Canadians say, 75%, according to the survey, that there's a need to protect youth and children from sports betting commercials and marketing. And again, I think we look at these surveys with a bit of a raised eyebrow in it, and have to look at how many people were contacted, the demographics around the respondents, et cetera. But David, just some quick thoughts on the survey results.
I had very similar thoughts to what Jess said. And in fact, Matthew Lohman wrote that for us on Play Canada this morning, which was, yeah, you have to look at who the people are that they're taking the data from, and that's people who are connected already to Maru. And who are these people? We don't really know. And yes, it was obvious that this would be kind of the numbers we would see from this. This is not a survey of Canadians. It's a survey of people who are connected to Maru. So yeah, what does it mean? Grab some headlines. It's worth discussion point, I guess. It doesn't really mean anything, though. The part about, I go back to something that Harley Redlick told me a while back about celebrities and it representing sports books. And his take was, you know, anybody who's even gambling just a little isn't going to be attracted to a sports book by Connor McDavid. That's clearly an attempt by sports books to groom kids to one day pick their sportsbook brand based on who they might have had a poster of up on the wall in their bedroom. So I tend to agree a lot with, like, yeah, anybody who's pretty serious about betting isn't going, well, I'm going to bet because Wayne Gretzky represents BetMGM, you know, but kids might be attracted to someone like Connor McDavid. So I do think that probably limiting that is a good move. And I was actually a little surprised that BetMGM spent the money to have him be an RG representative. And I thought, kudos to them. I mean, there is probably a positive, like Jeff said at the end, that there's more RG messaging. So, you know, that's great. I didn't think they'd spend the money to do it, but, you know, that's within the rules. So points.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder if that was just they've got McDavid locked into so many years in a contract, Dave, and they had to get, you know, the only way they could continue to use McDavid in Ontario would be through RG messaging. Hey, Jeff, sure. Jeff, did you want to add anything else with regards to the survey?
Not a ton more. I think we kind of hit all the notes there. I will just say, like, you know, there has been a very public pushback to the advertising that's gone on. And you know, those complaints were heard, and regulators have acted on it. So are people going to demand that Connor McDavid stop telling them to set deposit limits and to wager within their budgets? I'll be curious to see. But this was the advertising piece was something that regulators heard, and they tried to strike a balance, and they moved on. And I also think too, from an operator perspective, I'm sure there are a few of them that might be happy that they're not allowed to use athletes and certain celebrities for advertising because they are very costly, right? You have to shell out a lot for these guys to come hawk your products. And so now they have a very convenient reason to let those partnerships kind of, you know, dry up, wither away.
You know, we spent a pretty good chunk of the last 45 minutes talking about kind of some of the issues and challenges with the industry right now. And And I know the three of us, we've had conversations either in forums like this or when we see each other at conferences, and that's about communication and especially with regards to the AGCO and iGaming on Ontario. And this, you know, this isn't meant to, I like the people I've dealt with at the AGCO. I've had a chance to spend a bit of time with Doug Hood at the AGCO and Dave Phillips. And I had a chance to meet Karen Schnarr at the Global Gaming Expo back in October. And I also, you know, I think the three of us have spent some time with Martha Otten over the last 2 years. And I've got a lot of respect for Martha, and I really enjoy the conversations I've had with Mitch Davidson and iGaming Ontario as well. It does feel to me that Paul Burns, the head of the Canadian Gaming Association, has had to be the lead spokesperson for the industry, far, far too often. I mean, Paul's a great spokesman, but, other leaders in other parts of the regulated industry here in Ontario, I think they need to be heard more often. And I'm not sure if the AGCO and I go, if there's a lack of communication, because ultimately they serve at the behest of the Doug Ford government. And we've seen how transparent the Ford government is in our province right now. But Jeff, maybe just start with you. Just your thoughts on that. And it does feel to me like this is a time where leaders in the industry do need to step up and be willing to talk about issues and have those conversations and be more transparent in dealing with the media and other stakeholders.
Yeah, I totally agree. And earlier I mentioned kind of looking at what's happened in Ontario and in Canada around sports betting and iGaming through a US perspective and a US lens. And part of that is looking at the regulation and legislation and the governance of the industry through that lens too, where, you know, I can pick up a phone and get a good number of US regulators on that phone. Like they'll answer my calls, they'll answer my emails personally. And that's something you don't necessarily have in Ontario, where you have to kind of go through that Canadian government apparatus, that sort of communication structure that's been set up through years of, you know, fine-tuning how public officials interact with the media. And so that can be a bit of a hindrance too. And we haven't seen the same appetite as well by the government, by regulators, to have these same sort of situations where in the US you'll see operators kind of get called on the carpet, and they'll be brought in to, you know, before gaming commissions and public hearings and have to answer for, fines and any kind of potential misconduct they could have run into if they stepped over the line when it comes to the regulations. And, you know, I think that kind of thing is, you know, reporters in the US see, you know, they're familiar with their situation there. And then they kind of look at Canada, and you don't have the same sort of transparency. And I think we're seeing it be adopted a bit when it comes to the revenue reporting. Like, we're getting more thorough disclosure on that front. But you don't have that same sort of level of reactiveness and, kind of proactivity on that you see from, like, you know, the Ohio Casino Control Commission, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, which are very quick to call in operators and have public hearings and make them sort of explain themselves and what they're doing to the regulator, but it's in a public setting, so they're really explaining themselves to the state as well.
Dave, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. A lot with Jeff's experience. It's funny, at Katina Media, I'm sort of the Canadian translator for the American people that work there, and they have some challenges understanding this. So you say, well, that's not how it works in Canada, and they don't understand why. So I explain how government works, and it's different, and it's not as transparent. I explain that we give our numbers quarterly, like I mentioned earlier, and they don't understand that. And yet within government circles, IGO is relatively transparent compared to some of the other departments in the Ford government. And, you know, and that's not just him. His predecessors weren't any more transparent that I ever experienced. So IGO is actually giving you something. It's just about 10% of what most US states give you. And the access thing is a point that I agree with Jeff, that you can contact the Michigan Gaming Control Board and get somebody to respond to you relatively quickly. You might not get everything you want, nor should you, but they're pretty proactive and pretty transparent and pretty open to discussing it. So listen, I go AGCO. It would be wonderful if they did a little better on that front, because that's it. We all know transparency is the better way to go. And they're operating a relatively positive industry here. I mean, it's been very successful. Nobody faults them for the effort on trying to keep it from getting crazy. They've taken some different approaches to how you can promote the industry, and you know, their heart's in the right place. Not everything has worked perfectly, and not everything will work perfectly, but I think they're trying to walk that line between an open industry and be somewhat responsible.
Hey, Jeff, you mentioned the innovation and product piece. Is there anything else, any other storylines that you might be keeping an eye on as we enter the third year of Ontario's regulated market?
Well, I think it kind of goes to what Dave was just talking about there, and it's the regulation and the oversight and how that evolves. And I agree that, you know, IGO as an agency is kind of adopting some more of these U.S. traits of transparency, right, where it's much more accessible than some other parts of government. And again, Dave sort of touched on this too, what's happening with political communication strategies nowadays is something that's been going on for decades, right? Like I was at Queen's Park from 2014 to 2017. And it was the same thing. You know, if you want an answer, you have to kind of go through the communications department, and it gets run all the way up to the Premier's office, and it comes back to you in an answer that might not necessarily answer what you asked, but that's your answer. So I'm curious to see just where we go in response to some of these current headlines we're seeing. So the Jontay Porter NBA prop betting situation that popped up, you know, this was something that came to light through the legal sports betting apparatus, right? Like it was flagged by somebody somewhere in the legal system, you know, at the operator level, shared through those integrity monitoring services, and finally came to light. And it was something that you would not have caught through an unregulated sports because there's no incentive to report anything potentially suspicious that they could have seen. So I'm curious to see like what happens from there, because there was an interesting response from you know, the AGCO, from IGO, that they're sort of on the case, alleged case, so to speak. They're looking at it. They even have the embedded Ontario Provincial Police Agency that's part of the AGCO looking at it and weighing whether they need to launch a criminal investigation, if there's something there for them to look at. And that also goes to, you know, you mentioned Declan Hill earlier and match fixing and that sort of thing, where there was this big debate around whether Canadian law has provisions in it that can address any alleged match fixing.
Right.
And the OPB and the AGCO were saying last week that, you know, they're looking, that there are certain provisions that you can look at when it comes to potential match fixing that they could employ here, that, you know, looking at cheat at play or betting with intent to defraud someone. So that would almost be a test of that question, you know, whether Canada has the appropriate legal infrastructure to go after any kind of shenanigans that way. So I'm curious to see just how the regulation sort of evolves as we go forward, because, you know, we're having this recent burst of negative headlines, you could call it. But, you know, there's always going to be these situations with sports betting, with regulated sports betting, and the system's in place in part to catch these things and to bring them to light. And then the question becomes, once they're out there in the sun for everyone to see, like, what do you do?
Yeah. Dave?
Yeah. Again, I agree with almost everything Jeff says here. So it is interesting that they're going to look into it. And we did see that with the AGCO and UFC. They were one of the first to address, hey, something's not right here. And that, you know, that helped fix the problem, right? That spread to other jurisdictions, or was being looked at by other jurisdictions. And then the UFC stepped in and fixed a clearly problematic set of rules for their sport. So, you know, we know the AGCO and IGO are going to be pretty proactive on this. We do know they've leveled quite a high number of fines already. They don't do, what Jeff is suggesting and drag you in front of a court of public opinion there quite as much, but they do levy a lot of fines. So I think they are trying to straddle this and make sure they're the guardrail to prevent bad actors. What I hope the industry in Ontario does to go to swing it back a little bit to RG is more funding for those programs, I think, is needed. And I like the example given by Jess yesterday about the percentage in Georgia. We need to get the percentage higher, and Ontario is one of the good jurisdictions on that front. They're close or about at the 1% that the national Council on Problem Gambling suggests should be kind of just the bare minimum of how much should go to RG funding. So that's another avenue. I know the AGCO is trying to set up province-wide exclusion lists. That's a great incentive. I think they, it'd be nice if they got going a little faster on that, but progress is being made. And that should, in today's day and age, you should be able to exclude yourself from all operators at once rather than have to do it piecemeal.
Yeah, I think the RG story is one that the industry, we talked about earlier, I mean, it's struggled with in the U.S., and I would suggest it's the same case in Ontario, and it's been a pet peeve of Dr. Michael Narain from Brock University, who's been on our LinkedIn audio shows in the past and has talked about the lack of funding that's available. And I was actually surprised, guys, that unless I missed it, that when the Ford government released its new budget last week, I mean, again, this gambling industry has brought in over $500 million in tax revenue since it started. And to me, it's a no-brainer to earmark a percentage of those funds and give an actual dollar figure and put it towards mental health or gambling addiction programs. And that, I don't believe that happened last week. And it almost feels like the whole responsible gambling thing is a bit of an alphabet soup now. You know, the Responsible Gambling Council held this discovery council last week, and then you have an organization called GRIO, and all the operators talk about responsible gambling, and the regulators talk about responsible gambling. So I think it would be incumbent for everybody to get on the same page, ultimately to help people who do suffer from gambling addiction. Dave, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and you have to, you just brought it up, Steve, you have to go hunting to find out where that funding is. And some of it is under, Health and Human Services, or I'm dealing with so many states and provinces at the moment, I can't remember which is which, but that seems to be an American term for it. But the health ministry has some mental health and addiction services funding, and some of that goes toward gambling, and then some comes from here and some comes from there. We tried to find, what the percentage was, and we could find, if you go through some annual reports and budget documents and things, you can kind of piece together that Ontario's somewhat close to maybe 1% of all this, but that's not enough. You said it. And it's the easiest thing in the world to do it from the very beginning, is say, you're going to devote this much to problem gambling. And the operators, most of them tell you that's a good thing for them as well, right? They don't want to have a huge gambling problem. They want to keep their customers gambling safely for the long term. That's good business. So yeah, I hope this is a thing that they, so much money comes in, you could take a much larger percentage and it still wouldn't really have a huge impact on the bottom line for the province, and devote it to some programs and publicize it. Tell everybody, that's the first thing you should tell everybody. X percent goes to, problem gambling resources. Here's where you can find them. They do a nice job of responsible gambling messages. I go insisting on all those kind of things and trying to get people to set limits, et cetera, but more can be done.
Jeff, you want to add to that?
Yeah, the one thing that's nice about when you look at U.S. legislation with regards to sports betting is it's a very kind of clean process where they have a sports betting bill. The bill says sports betting is legal. Here's how it's going to be legal. Here's how many operators. Here's what you can bet on. Here's how old you have to be. And it spells out everything, including all the way down to here's how we're going to spend the money that we raise from sports betting. And that becomes a signal of the priorities of any given state. So in Georgia, for instance, we were talking earlier, where sports betting, when it was going to be legalized, it's not going to be legalized this year, but the plan was to take the proceeds from sports betting and to plow it into educational programs,
tuition and scholarships for post-secondary, and a big chunk for voluntary pre-kindergarten programs. And then, as Jessica mentioned earlier, they had carved out 15% of the proceeds for problem gambling. That's a huge signal to people of how big a priority that is for you. And so Ontario, it was, you know, how things, the system came to be, it wasn't that kind of neat and tidy process where it's like, this is the sports betting or this is the iGaming bill and here's all of everything spelled out. And so there was not a big trumpeting of what the priorities for the proceeds were. And now they're just kind of becoming part of that general revenue fund, which is doesn't mean that the province can't not go out there and make a big announcement and say, like, we're setting aside X number of dollars this year for RG programs, for CAMH, for whoever, to help with this. You know, they still could. You just didn't have that same sort of process where it was very clear from the outset what was going to be spent on what.
Hey guys, last question, and that's we do know that the Alberta government that it is looking at that adopting a regulated model, and there was $1 million in the last Alberta budget released back in March that provides, I guess, some funding for research and to move towards a regulated environment. We've seen the kind of the bun fight between Loto-Québec and the finance ministry in Quebec and the Quebec Online Gaming Coalition about regulated gambling in Quebec. Again, BC seems to me to be a place that would be ripe for the picking for a regulated market, given the presence of so many gaming industry companies right now in the province, along with a province that's quite well populated and already has a pretty boisterous gambling industry, I believe, especially led by BCLC. Just some, Jeff, any predictions or thoughts on whether or not we might see any movement, like concrete movement with Alberta or any of the other two provinces this year?
Concrete, I don't know. I'm skeptical, partly because of the current climate where we've seen these headlines pop up over the past few weeks. What ministers gonna want to go out right now and say, we need more sports betting, we need more online gambling right now, while they're still trying to figure out what's going on, you know, in the NBA and in the MLB. So I'm a bit bearish on the prospect of anything publicly and concrete. Could be a lot of work gets done out of the public eye with the study, as you know, that's going to be done in Alberta. Alberta is still kind of my leading candidate for any real concrete progress, both because you have a conservative government similar to the one in Ontario that is supposed to be a sort of a more business-friendly regime, and also too because they have actually put it down in writing that they're looking at a new online gambling strategy, that they want to do something there. So they've, you know, called their shot, so to speak, and so they have to kind of act on that. So I don't know if there's going to be any big, bold moves, but I think there could still be some movement in Alberta. And the other, you know, BC, Quebec, I'm not quite sold on yet.
Final word to you, Dave.
I agree. It's going to be Alberta if it's going to be any of them, I think. And you know, it's to what Jeff said. It's Danielle Smith's business-friendly environment and being a conservative government and wanting to raise money. And, you know, who knows, maybe this helps fund their constant moves to separate from the rest of Canada. Not totally, but in many cases, if you look at the pension fund issue and other things that they take, they're at odds with the Trudeau government. So this could, you know, help them become even more independent. It, you know, it's such an obvious, you know, I struggle to understand why many of the governments in this country are so opposed to it. Yes, current climate of headlines probably doesn't help. Jeff's right. But beyond that, it's the stuff we all know, which is, you know, a regulated, controlled industry is better than what we have now, which is a massive gray market in this country. And you know, it's been going on for anywhere up to 20 years of people betting illegally. So why don't you want to, you know, regulate it, tax it, protect your consumers, devote money to problem gambling, all of those things we've talked about in this last hour. And it's you know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, this argument that, you know, to not offer it is kind of similar in my head to, like, you put a bag over your head when somebody is being robbed right in front of you, and then you say it didn't happen because you didn't see it. You know, it's like, it's out there. It's happening. People are gambling illegally en masse. We know that. So, you know, that's one of the success stories in Ontario. They said part of the reason beyond money, obviously, was to bring people in from the gray market. And, you know, they tout quite a success rate, somewhere north of 80%, I guess, is what IGO has said. And hey, that's, if that's true, that's pretty darn successful. That's doing what you're trying to eliminate. People gambling illegally. You can't shut them off cold, so you attract them to the legal market.
Dave Briggs is Catena Media's managing editor of its news coverage on Play Canada, Play Michigan, and the Play Pennsylvania websites. Also host of the Fresh Waves podcast. You can find Dave on X at dbriggs, B-R-I-G-G-S, 1969. Jeff Sakodny is the gambling industry beat writer for covers.com. As always, you can find Jeff on X as well as at Jeff Sakodny, Jeff G-E-O-F-F, Sakodny, Z-O-C-H-O-D-N-E. Hey guys, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. It was long overdue to get the two of you together along with Jessica Wellman from SBC Americas. And let's do this again before, maybe we'll do it either before the Canadian Gaming Summit or hopefully the three of us will be together in Toronto in June, and maybe we'll do a live podcast then, guys.
Thanks, Steve. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me on. This was great.
As always, the Gaming News Canada show is available at gamingnewscanada.ca along with the various podcast platforms. And again, we thank Jeff Sakodny, Dave Briggs, and Jessica Wellman for being with us today. And we look forward to seeing everybody again on the Gaming News Canada Show podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Gaming News Canada Show. Sign up for our newsletter at gamingnewscanada.ca. Follow Steve McAllister on LinkedIn. Message Steve if you're interested in being a sponsor or featured guest.